it is gone. A two-run home run for Rhys Hoskins into the second deck for Bryce Harper. Swing and a miss. He got him. And Aaron Nola leads two. Segura on the run. Reaches up and makes the grab.
Swing and a miss. Struck him out.
Now batting for the Phillies, John Stolness.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome back to another edition of Hittin' Season, and this is a very special edition of Hittin' Season, episode number 372. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight. You can follow me on Twitter at John Stolness. As I mentioned, we have a very special show here. We're going to do two shows here in the middle of the week because I have a great show coming up. I think it's going to come out on Thursday morning, Thursday afternoon at some point, where we will talk with D.B. Firstman about her new book, Hall of Name, Baseball's Most Magnificent Monikers, and we'll get into the latest with Major League Baseball's discussions on how they might start the 2020 season here sooner than maybe any of us thought. We're going to do all that coming up on episode 373, and that will probably come out either on late Wednesday or early Thursday morning. But in the meantime, we have a terrific guest here on this special episode of the podcast. I've been trying to talk to as many people as I can here on the podcast, get their thoughts on what's going on, and I am super excited about our next guest. I've been wanting to talk to him for a long time. Former Philadelphia Phillies general manager Ruben Amaro Jr. joining Hittin' Season for the first time. Ruben, thank you so much for coming on. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Under circumstances, it's as we all know, it's a difficult time of the difficult time for everyone. But hanging in there, family's doing fine, and hoping and praying that the people that are on the front lines are hanging in there.
Yeah, no, I can't imagine. I can't imagine the people on the front lines, especially in places like New York and people working in emergency rooms and people in Louisiana, the hot spots around the country. And yeah, everybody's doing their part right now, hopefully to help flatten the curve and make this thing go away sooner rather than later. In the meantime, we're just trying to provide some people with some entertainment here on the podcast, and having you on is really an honor. So thank you again for coming on. Folks, Ruben Amaro Jr. is now on Twitter, if you didn't know. So make sure that you give him a follow at RAJr_20. And now back in Philadelphia, Ruben. I mean, you were in Boston after you left Philadelphia for a couple of seasons as the first base coach. You went to New York. You were on the field staff there for a season. And then last season, you were with Brody Van Wagenen as an advisor. How does it feel to be back in Philadelphia?
Well, it's great to be back in Philly. I mean, this is my home. This is where, you know, I bleed Philly's red. And, you know, obviously with the background with my father having a long history here in the organization and me, myself, as a player, as an executive, even as a bat boy, it's nice to be back. These are where my roots are. I had a great journey and had a lot of fun doing some of the things that I've had an opportunity to do. But it's great to be back.
Well, and you mentioned your father, and I think your appearances on the Goldbergs, where you play your father on the show, it really is spectacular, and you are hysterical doing the deadpan thing. How did you get connected to doing the show? How did that all come about?
So I got a call when I was actually putting a uniform on for the first time in spring training again in Boston, actually in Fort Myers at our site there. And Kevin Gregg, who used to be one of the media directors in Philadelphia, is now running the show there in Boston, came in and said, you know, there's a show that wants to utilize your likeness and your name. Should I have him, you know, send the link and such to hook it up? And lo and behold, they sent me a script that was amazing. Had nothing but Ruben Amaro Jr. in there. I was astonished. And this is really the story, is that Adam Goldberg, who is the creator of the show, went to Penn Charter, which is where I went to high school, middle school and high school. And I guess some of the notoriety that, you know, I guess I've gained over the years from being there, for some reason, when he was younger, I guess he's about 10 years behind me, and he decided to use, you know, my name and my character in the show, and naturally I gave him the opportunity to do that. And I think one of the neatest things about having that opportunity was my dad had recently passed. He passed in March 31st, 2017, and right after that, they actually asked me to come on the show and portray him And that was really an honor. It was really neat for Adam to, give me the opportunity to do that. And I thought that was kind of a cool thing to do.
It really is cool. And it's so funny. It's such a great show. And hopefully we'll see you on it again soon here over the next, as long as it's on the air. It'd be great to kind of make it like, I'd love to see you on like annually, an episode or two a season. So
that'd be fine by me. I told Adam, I've had a couple of meetings with him now and he's a great guy and he's had great success. I think he's got some other projects in the works right now, but we email from time to time and, I tell him, whenever you want me on, I'm available.
That's great. So let's talk a little bit about the environment we're in right now. And let's look at it from a baseball perspective. There was a story that came out on Tuesday where it looks like Major League Baseball and the Players Union, with seemingly the support of some of the federal health authorities, are looking at maybe starting the season as early as May with everybody playing in Arizona with the 10 spring training facilities, maybe a couple other facilities there at Chase Field. There's obviously so many logistics and so much that would have to go into making something like that happen. As a former executive with the Phillies for a long time and again with the Mets last year, what are some of the moving pieces? What are some of the things that you think might be the easiest to solve or what things could be some major obstacles that would have to be overcome? How feasible is this, basically?
That's a great question, John. I'm not really quite sure. I think it's you're talking about probably quarantining. And now in today's day and age, you're talking about not just the players, but you're also talking about the staff and the personnel, the umpires, the TV crews. You're talking about a whole slew of other ancillary parts of the of each organization that is going to have to be there and either quarantined or tested on a regular basis. And I just think it's a very, very difficult task to undertake. Is it possible? I guess anything's possible almost, but I think there's some difficulties there. You're talking about anywhere from 50 to 70 people that have to be there per club, how to house them, how to test them in and out of the facilities. You're talking about umpiring crews. You're talking about being able to support the team with minor league players.
Right.
How are they going to be, in case you have injury? What mm-hmm. are the rosters going to look like? I mean, there are a whole slew. I mean, you said it yourself, the logistics of it all is pretty daunting. But there's some intelligent people at the Major League Baseball Players Association, as well as the commissioner's office. And I think that there are maybe some solutions. I would be careful about how to move this thing forward. I think that we still have to keep in mind that while baseball and sports and other diversions are an important part of our culture, I think we also have to be very cognizant of everyone's health. And also, to make sure that, we're really doing things right. And yes, I think people would love to have sports and in particular baseball being played right now. But I think that we have to also have truly be conscious of how this will affect our society health-wise.
Right. No, you're right. The emotional aspect of having sports back would be tremendously uplifting. And I know Major League Baseball wants to be the first sport back. I'm sure they would love to have that mantle, but it's got to be done in a way that keeps everybody safe. And I think that's the big thing. And I'm sure they won't do anything if it's going to jeopardize. One of the other things I've seen mentioned is that they would have to come up with a quick turnaround test that would enable people to be tested and get results back within 5 or 10 minutes and have that readily available before they even begin to do something like that. And I know those tests are out there, but they're not readily available at this point. So I guess we're just going to have to see what happens here over the next few weeks. But it looks like maybe some hope we get a 2020 season here after all. So I wanted to talk a little bit about your path because it's so interesting, your decision when you were let go by the Phillies and you decided to go to Boston and return to being an on-field staff member. You rarely see a person go from being the general manager of a club, a successful general manager who took a team to the World Series and to the playoffs three times in total, to go to being a first base coach, back to the on-the-field aspect of the game. And you obviously were a player for a number of years, so that's not a foreign concept to you being on the field. What made you decide to go back on the field and then last year decide to go back into the front office?
I think it was for several reasons, John. I think one of the things that, when you're in a front office and you're kind of seeing things from 500 feet, and for someone who throughout his career. I mean, I tried to learn the game. I tried to understand the game. I was a bench player for most of my major league career. And so you get an opportunity to try to understand and learn the game, what things work well in an organization, what things work well as a manager, what things work well as a coach and as a player. And I've, forever been interested in learning parts of the game that that are critical to success, right? So, and I had a great opportunity to play on some great clubs and some not so great clubs, and play for some great managers and some not so great managers. And I think that part of the process here, as I after I was let go, for me, it was almost like, one door closes and maybe another one opens up. And I had always thought about what it would be like to be back down on the field in a managerial type of a position. So originally, my thought process was, okay, if that's something I'm going to do or want to do as a, and create that as a goal, I better get back down on the field somehow. And when John Farrell called and I talked to Dave Dombrowski there subsequently, John and Dave in Boston, and that opportunity arose, I thought to myself, well, geographically, it's very desirable. Boston is one of the best organizations in all of baseball. I did a little research talking with a couple of friends of mine who had been in the organization, and I had a great concern about how I would be treated as an employee because I was so spoiled in Philadelphia with the way David Montgomery and all the people, the VPs and all the people that kind of run the ownership group, how they treated people and employees. So I was concerned about making a move in general, but that's something you have to do in baseball, correct? So, so I made the decision. I went to Boston. I had a very have a nice conversation with John Farrell. I had lunch with, I guess it was Mike Hazen and Dave Dombrowski and John Farrell, and I walked out of the room, or they walked out of the room while I was having lunch, and they came back and offered me the job. Of being, the outfield coach and base running coach. I had a great relationship with John Farrell as a teammate of his, and I'd known him for a long time. He is an executive with Cleveland originally, and then on to being on the field as a coach and as a manager. And it was just a great opportunity for me. I felt that was like a neat opportunity for me to learn the game, get back down on the turf and on the dirt with the players. And to really get a better understanding of what motivates the players, what is important to them, how can I impact them, and just learn from a really cool group of guys. That the people that I worked with there, as far as the coaching staff is concerned, was just a bunch of guys who I had played with for many years. I mean, it was with Chili Davis, who I was with in California briefly and known for a long time. He was a hitting coach. Vic Rodriguez, I was a teammate of mine in Scranton. He was a secondary hitting coach. We had at the time Carl Willis, who I had interviewed as a possible pitching coach. Torrey Lobello, and then Gary DeSarcina, both of which were teammates of mine. So all types of people that I really had a great deal of respect for, and even Brian Butterfield, who had been a longtime coach who I'd known probably more from afar, but I got an opportunity to be around a great group of baseball people in a city that was a demanding, northeast city with a great culture. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a really nice path for me to maybe give a shot at managing, and still is something that I've thought about.
So, which did you prefer? Do you have a preference as far as being in the front office or being on the field? Because it sounds to me what you're saying is like you'd still like that opportunity of managing at some point.
I mean, it would be great to have that opportunity. I think that I also don't want to shut any doors. I know people have asked this question, like which route would you rather take? Would you rather be a GM or would you rather be a manager? And the reality of it is, I would like to, and I believe that I have the skill set to do either one. I'm open to doing either one. I love baseball. It's in my blood. I have had a great opportunity because of people like Ed Wade and Pat Gillick and Dallas Green to have to get the background on off the field in a front office setting to learn the game in that regard and have that perspective. But I've also, you know, as a player and now as a coach in both Boston and New York, have had a great opportunity to learn what it may take to be a quality manager. And I think all those experiences have brought me to here where I feel like I have the ability to do either one. But you know, it's, life is a journey and baseball is a journey. And as far as I'm concerned, as long as I'm working in baseball, I'm a happy man.
Well, when we get back, we'll talk to Ruben about analytics a little bit and some of the moves that he is happiest about and maybe some moves that he may have regretted during his time as Phillies GM. We'll do that next here on Hittin' Season. And we're back on Hittin' Season talking with Ruben Amaro Jr., former Phillies GM. One of the things that has changed since when you were the GM of the Phillies is the explosion of analytics in baseball. And, you know, the Phillies now have a robust analytics department. I know one of the criticisms you probably heard a lot when you were the general manager is maybe the team being a little bit slow to embrace analytics. And I'll be perfectly honest with you, I was one of the people who was calling for the team to embrace analytics a little bit earlier than I think they did. As we've seen over the last couple of years, analytics really has exploded, and the Phillies have been utilizing it to the nth degree. And during the last 2 years, I know when Gabe Kapler was here, we saw the use of analytics being used a lot more, but still not really seeing it result in wins on the field, at least not as many as were expected. So I wanted to get your take. Now that you're kind of, you've been general manager with the Phillies before the analytics craze really got going, and you were in the Mets front office last year, you spent time on the field with the Red Sox and the Mets, two teams that both really use analytics a lot. What's your take on this, on the use of analytics in baseball right now?
Yeah, John, it's a great question, and I guess it's a fair assessment as far as my tenure as a GM, and probably was a little late getting into that. We had so much success doing things the way we were doing them that maybe we were a little too late to the party. That said, that was also one of the reasons why, you know, getting back onto the field and getting an understanding of, at the player level, what was important to the players, what was becoming the things that were going to be effective for them as players. And I got an opportunity to learn a lot about the analytics in both Boston and New York and in my own studies on it. And frankly, just like in any other part of, you know, assessing what is important to a game, what is important for success, I think the analytics piece has become very important. I guess there is the thought process out there that I didn't believe in it at all. Well, the fact of the matter was that we were utilizing some of these things, not quite as advanced by the time we left as maybe we should have. But there are pluses and minuses to everything, right? There are pieces of analytics that are absolutely brilliant that that need to be utilized, and there is information there that can be developed that can create greater success. There are also pieces of analytics in some cases, in my mind, particularly on the offensive side of the game, where there are times when, you know, less is more. And something I learned from Charlie Manuel and guys like Joe Maddon, who are probably the best hitting coaches I've ever been around, whereby when you start to take that analytics piece and you start to ingrain certain things in guys' heads, you know, sometimes you have to take your mind out of some certain thought processes when you're actually performing. There's a, you know, paralysis by overanalysis, and I think there's a time and a place to work on some of these things. But when you get into a game situation, I think the most important thing is to concentrate on making, you know, some good solid contact and making sure that you're hitting with a purpose. And I think what has happened now in our game, which is a little disconcerting for me, is that there is more importance on driving the ball out of the ballpark than there is in creating opportunities to score runs. And I think some of the thought process behind that has created a game that is a little less entertaining, I believe, and frankly, not quite as efficient as perhaps some of the people who are touting this are making it. I think that hitting a home run is great, but not everybody can hit a home run. And I think runs can be created in other ways that I think people And our fans deserve to see more regularly. And I hope that that things kind of swing around. If you see some of the clubs like the Washington Nationals, for instance, it's a very, very good example of how they approach their two-strike approach. The fact that the Boston Red Sox probably had the best two-strike approach in baseball when they won the World Series. I think their numbers were astounding with two strikes. And making contact and putting the ball in play and those sorts of things. I think that that has gotten, I think our game has gotten away from that. I hope it comes back because I think it's going to create a better quality of game. And I also think it's going to create a more entertaining game for our fans.
And I think a lot of fans agree with you. I mean, I even for someone like me who was really pushing for analytics, what we've seen over the last couple of years hasn't made a whole lot of sense either. And I think that's one of the reasons why Phillies fans are excited to see Joe Girardi come into town, because I think there's a sense anyway that he'll have a better idea how to blend these two things together, how to blend the analytics with maybe the gut reaction, the gut decisions that a manager needs to have, not overloading a guy with information. I think we heard Rhys Hoskins talk this off season about sometimes he'd get in his head too much and overanalyze things and the need to simplify things a little bit. And I think that's an area where once we get this 2020 season going, if we get this 2020 season going, I know a lot of Phillies fans are hopeful that the team starts to find a better balance for the way things used to be and the new school analytics and where baseball appears to be headed at this point.
John, I think if you don't mind, I'd like to also add, I mean, there's just a balance to everything, correct? I don't think that, people talk about old school versus new school, and the reality of it is, and I'll coin a phrase that a good friend of mine in baseball picked up, and it's really, we're all in school, right? We're consistently trying to learn.
Right.
We're consistently trying to learn the game and create a balance whereby there are some fundamental things that need to happen to have success for a club. And you add the very interesting and intricate and innovative analytics piece of this process, and that's where you can really gain ground and have success. Because at the end of the day, you want to build a product that is entertaining to watch and a product that's winning, right? And the best way to do that is to utilize all pieces of information, whether it be through the scouts evaluation or analytical evaluation. I think a combination of that and utilized in a productive manner is the way to go.
Before we wrap up, I did want to just ask you a couple of quick questions about your time as the GM here in Philadelphia, because you obviously saw, you were here, you were at the helm for some of its highest highs, that 2009 season. I think I actually enjoyed the 2009 season more than the 2008 season, because that 09 team just had a feeling of invincibility once they got into the playoffs, and man, it felt like the team was going to steamroll to another World Series over the Yankees, and unfortunately, it came up short that season, but it was just such a great time to be a Phillies fan with the Phillies being the elite team in the National League. We hadn't really experienced that since the 70s and early 80s. And you were also at the helm as the rebuild began, as the players got older. And I think in retrospect, in hindsight, you're getting a lot more credit for some of the moves towards the end of your tenure. The Cole Hamels trade, for example. I think the Jimmy Rollins trade was something that yielded a lot of fruit. A lot of trades you pulled off towards the end of your tenure has helped. You know, you got some value around the margins, and so I think there's more of a recognition from the fans, especially towards the end of your tenure, helping set this team up for the future. And I noticed on Twitter you were asked some questions about what your best move was. I think you mentioned the Roy Halladay trade and a move that if you could go back and do it again. Well, let me ask you, a move you could go back and do again, which is of your transactions, which is one that you would do differently if you could?
Well, I mean, the Cliff Lee trade, clearly, when we acquired Roy Halladay, one of the mandates that I kind of had was to try to add as much talent, since we were kept sucking out talent out of our organization with the many trades that we made. I mean, they're all trades designed to have success now and in the future, because we did extend some of these. They're all trades basically made that whereby we would keep those players for more than 1 year or more than half of a year. One of the mandates that we had was to try to replenish and you know, frankly, we were in a position where we didn't want the fans to think that we were going to be able to keep both Roy and Cliff Lee. And I think that, you know, when you create a fan base that is that has a such a high expectation, we decided that it was important, even though we were gaining a great one in Roy, that we also kind of had to try to make that move to replenish with the Cliff Lee trade. Now, they were all, I think more than anything else, had been a little bit more patient with the move and allowed some time to develop that marketplace for Cliff. Mm-hmm. We did talk to a couple of clubs about it, but we were focused on some of the talent that Seattle had. They were younger players, unfortunately not as close to the big leagues as maybe we would have liked. But, you know, sometimes things work out, sometimes don't, with, you know, players like Filippo Mott and J.C. Ramirez and
Tyson Gillies.
Tyson Gillies. They were very, very talented kids, but they were young. And you know, obviously the further away from the major leagues they are, the more difficult it is to assess them. But and it didn't really work out. But, you know, you do things for a reason. Sometimes the reason is not the right reason. But, you know, in that situation, it was sort of a mandate that we couldn't really keep both of them at the time. And without getting into too much of that, that was more the mandate. And I think the other deal that we made when in 2012, when we moved Hunter Pence, you know, we did have a that was more money related than anything else. We were trying to make sure that we knew at that time, sadly, that we were not necessarily going to be a contending team. Our guys just couldn't step up when we had all those injuries to Chase and the big piece, and also to Roy Halladay. Our feeling was that we were just not going to be able to make a playoff run. So we decided that it was not in our best interest to go over the luxury tax at that time, and we made the decisions based on money. And that was that's a less hard lesson learned. And and when you make moves because of money, then you typically don't make the talent moves that you want to make. Now, we ended up with some pretty decent players, but really probably could have done a little bit better had we been a little bit more talent focused as opposed to trying to get underneath the luxury tax.
Well, and let's end on a positive note. Give me like one or two moves if you could, and maybe an under the radar move that people may not think about, but that you're particularly proud of, but that you really liked. You look back and you say, man, that was a pretty good deal we made.
Well, you know what? And at the time I was not the GM, but I was the assistant GM. And one of the moves that I think that we made, we ended up picking up J.C. Romero, and he ended up being, and he was kind of off the scrap heap sort of, mm-hmm. and we brought him in. He worked before we activated him, he worked with Carlos Arroyo, one of our longtime pitching coaches down in the minor leagues. And he had a familiarity with him because they're both, they're both Puerto Rican, and they both played, and they knew each other quite well from the Puerto Rican League and over time. And he regained a confidence that he had not had for a long time. And when we picked him up, it was kind of an under the radar type of a move. And ended up being a huge one for us because he pitched his butt off for us, in the seventh inning, both against righties and lefties. He was effective. Sometimes effectively wild, but had a tremendous, did a great job of like nailing down the seventh and eighth inning when we had that system working with he and Madsen and then Lidge in 2008 when we won the World Series. I mean, it was really a thing of beauty. And I think the other one was Matt Stairs. Again, I was a part of making that move. Pat and I had talked about, adding some power to our bench. Particularly for a team, you know, it's kind of a luxury player because he wasn't real versatile, but we needed some power off the bench from the left side. And lo and behold, the man hits one of the biggest home runs in Philly's history to help us, move forward in the NLCS. So those are some of the under the radar moves. I think one of the other moves that was a very difficult one for me personally, because I had such a good relationship with him, was allowing Pat Burrell to go and then mm-hmm. signing Raul Ibanez. And Raul, for me, was almost the epitome of quality as a player and as a person. He was an older player, and there was a lot of discussion about, you know, well, is this guy going to be able to keep up his production? And Rule ended up being just absolutely outstanding for us on a number of levels. Shoot, before he got hurt first half his first year, he was probably an MVP candidate. But
yeah.
But those are some of the moves that I think, obviously, Roy Halladay one is the one that I love the most. Sure. And he was kind of my white whale, but those are some of the other moves I think that were made that that really helped propel us in a lot of ways and helped keep the process going.
Well, and hey, the Cliff Lee trade in 09 where you acquired him. I mean, you guys don't go to the World Series without making that trade. And I thought you might mention Pedro Martinez because, I mean, that move also was really important for you guys winning the pennant in 2009. And the Lee trade worked out great for the Indians, too, because they got Carlos Carrasco. I imagine as a GM, it's always satisfying when you make a move that benefits you and benefits the team you're trading with.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole point. I mean, I always believed in giving up quality for quality. And in most of the deals that we made, I mean, we give up some pretty darn good prospects. Not too many of them bit us in the butt, though, later on. I mean, there weren't that many other than Carrasco, who ended up developing kind of late. It took him maybe 5 or 6 years to really get to that point. Would he have run out of time in Philadelphia? I don't know. Love the kid, great kid, wonderful person. We just felt like if we acquired a guy like Cliff Lee at the trade deadline and the way he pitched, I mean, that ended up working out extremely well for us. And as far as the Pedro Martinez trade is concerned, I got to give some credit to Scott Profrock on that one because he was kind of sitting out there and hadn't pitched. And then I heard and he had heard and done some research that he'd been throwing down in the Dominican, throwing batting practice and such, and had a nice long discussion with him about it and brought him on. And he was just absolutely spectacular on a number of levels. One is competitiveness. Two is brilliance. Three is experience. And just his presence was just terrific for us. And we, really enjoyed him being around on a number of different levels. So, I mean, listen, it takes a whole village to make these things happen. And with the quality of our system at the time and the fact that, these guys were developed in the right way and we assessed some pretty good players that we acquired, I think it all worked out pretty well for a while.
Well, listen, Ruben, you've had a fascinating career. I can't think of many people who've had a more interesting career than you have, and it's not over. And so hopefully the path is laid out in front of you to kind of pick whatever it is you want to do moving forward at some point. Folks, make sure if you are on Twitter, you're following Ruben Amaro Jr. at RAJr_20. And Ruben, thank you so much for coming on Hittin' Season. I really appreciate it.
John, thanks for having me. Enjoy.
And before we say goodbye, folks, just a reminder to check out the Hittin' Season Patreon. We've got some great stuff up on there. I've got a new Cards on the Table video up there for you guys to watch. And we've got some great episodes of Absolutely Hammered. And Justin's got some video stuff of the MLB The Show 2020 season that he's simulating. Some great content over at the Patreon. So make sure that you check all of that out at patreon.com/hittin'season. And don't forget to leave a rating and a review. Tell your friends about the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. Leave those 5-star ratings on Apple Podcasts and let us know what you think of the show. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in, and I'll talk to you all a little bit later in the week here on Hittin' Season.